All right, kids, strap on your law school shorts. It's patent week. Get ready for the intellectual property extravaganza. Today is February 25th, 2006, and this is the TMO2Go Weekly Roundup, a Mac Observer podcast. I'm Ricky Spiro. By the way, I went to the iTunes, the music store they got in there, and they've got the show listed there. The Weekly Roundup is listed in iTunes, which is cool. They've got reviews that you can do in the iTunes music store, and I happen to notice, by the way, that there were no reviews for this show up in iTunes. So, hey, if you get a chance, if you're looking for something really exciting to do, go do something else. But if you're just sitting there drinking Cheese Whiz, hanging out, run over to the iTunes music store and throw up a review. We'd really appreciate it. It helps people if they're looking for podcasts, want to know what might interest them. It really helps if there are some reviews up there. So, hey, we'd appreciate it if you did that. And as always, if you have comments on the show, please send them to roundup@macobserver.com. To get the full story on anything we cover in this podcast, you can visit macobserver.com/roundup. There's a joke in here somewhere. Steve Wonka? Willie Jobs? How about John and the Apple Factory? Okay, forget it. We're looking at patent filings, people. Let's do it. Okay, so intellectual property may not be what gets you out of bed in the morning, but it is a central issue for Apple Computer. The company relies heavily on interface patents. It files them frequently and defends them vigorously so that its hardware and software can maintain a distinct look and feel. This week, TMO's John Keat will join me to help build some context behind a handful of those patents. Right now, though, we'll begin with some information about the patents themselves. Digging into the archives, Apple filed for two patent applications on June 20th and October 22nd of 2003. They apparently cover Apple's window managing interface, Exposé, introduced in macOS 10.3. That's the version called Panther. The abstract describes the invention thus. The interface includes a user-selectable mode in which the windows are rearranged and resized if necessary so that all open windows can be simultaneously viewed within the area of the display, thereby enabling any one of the windows to be easily selected for access. Gee, it sounds so much more exciting when Steve Jobs talks about it during a keynote. On April 26, 2004, Apple also filed for a patent on the interface of its iTunes Music Store. Again, the filing's description of the invention: improved graphical user interfaces suitable for reviewing, browsing, previewing, and/or purchasing media items are disclosed. The graphical user interfaces are suitable for reviewing or browsing numerous media items. The graphical user interfaces are also suitable for previewing or purchasing media items in an online manner. The graphical user interfaces are particularly useful for a system that provides purchase and distribution of media in a client-server environment. Now, from the out-of-left-field department, on June 21st, 2004, Apple filed a patent for an integrated sensing display. The invention essentially melds a camera with a screen. That is, the screen's surface area itself is the camera. Each pixel would have an image capture element. Among the possibilities we can imagine, a way to make eye contact during video conferencing, for example, new types of interface controls, and maybe even new kinds of document scanning. We've also carried stories about patents that could be applied toward the creation of a tablet computer. The most recent would cover methods for gesture input on a touch-sensitive screen. The date of that patent application, titled Gestures for Touch-Sensitive Input Devices, is January 31st, 2005, about a year ago. The filing claims included methods for recognizing various commands, including a zoom gesture, a pan gesture, a rotate gesture, or a page turn. Pictures also included an on-screen virtual scroll wheel. And some unrelated news very briefly now before we fire up the context machine. Apple Computer has sent out invitations to the media for an event about fun new products that will occur this coming Tuesday. We're not going to spend any time on this right now, but check in next week if you're looking for some context after the announcements. Piper Jaffray analyst Gene Munster on Friday said he believes Apple may sell 300,000 iPods more than the 9 million units he has projected. Mr. Munster kept his outperform rating on Apple stock with a $103 price target U.S. Apple stock picked up steam this week, closing at $71.45 a share. Positive analyst comments, along with high hopes ahead of Apple's February 28th product rollout, seem to be fueling the rally. All right, back to patents. Now, perhaps I could be considered an intellectual property enthusiast, whatever that means, but I'm definitely not a lawyer. I did, however, think to call my lawyer, well, not mine, but TMO's. Well, not even that exactly. Forget it. Please welcome the devil's advocate himself, John Keat, Esquire. John, welcome to the show.
How you doing, Ricky? I want to make it very clear, I'm not your lawyer, and I'm not TMO's lawyer. nothing personal about that. There's a whole bag of issues that come along with it.
Fair enough. Let's start just generally talking about interface patents. I think most of the Mac observers out there, people that have watched Apple or similar companies for a while, know what it means to have an interface patent. But first of all, how useful are they? What do they protect? Why do people get them? What's their functional purpose?
Well, they're really useful, and they've gotten much more useful with time. There's a long protracted history about user interface patents, software patents in general, in the patent world, at least in the U.S. And the functionality that they protect is exactly what you would think. It's the user interface. It's what Apple lost on way back when they fought Microsoft and chose an incredibly brain damaged legal tactic. But that's a whole other story. But it will protect that, which is the user interface. So if Apple makes transparent dialogue boxes and they get a patent on it for that part of the user interface, nobody else will be able to do that.
So how easy or hard is it to protect an interface patent? Once you have it, are you guaranteed that no one else can have a transparent dialogue box?
That's a really good question, and it's not that easy to answer. There's more than one way to skin a cat, right? You can get basic copyright protection, which is just on the expression itself. So meaning, if Apple makes a funky looking trash can, nobody else can make that trash can. That's basically like a little work of art, and they get copyright protection and things automatically without doing anything, as does everybody else on the planet, basically. So that's a very weak form of protection, because if you make your trash can look just a little bit different, you're okay and you're not infringing on Apple's IP. Then there's a little bit stronger form of protection, and it's called a design patent. And it's for the ornamental design of something. So basically there, it's a very simple patent application, a draft. It has a single claim, and it says, I claim, and then you put in a picture of what you claim. Maybe it's a trash can, and around the trash can, you'll have a dotted line that represents a screen. And what you're telling the patent office is, look, I'm not claiming a trash can everywhere else in the world. I'm claiming a trash can on it as a computer-represented screen element.
Yeah,
and so that's a pretty easy thing to get, and it protects things ornamentally. So if you have a particular look of something that you want, assuming it's novel and nobody's done it before, you can get it. And then the third form of protection that's kind of ups the ante a bit is a utility patent, or what most people consider to be a normal patent. And there you have to describe how the function of the user interface takes place on the computer. So you might have some algorithms that say this is the way a transparent window is rendered in video memory and posted onto the screen in some layer and things of that nature. And that description can become very intricate. And it's a little bit more difficult to get protection because software is so infinitely malleable. You can skin a cat in more than one way, right? One programmer might do something one way, another program might do it another way. So to get the protection, you have to write these magic paragraphs or sentences called claims, and you have to claim it from so many different angles that to make sure that nobody else finds a different way of doing basically the same thing and getting around your pen. And that can get a little bit more complicated to do a really good job.
Fair enough. So we know that many Mac observers know that Apple's really big on interface patents. They use them a lot. Do you know of any other companies that are known for relying on them very heavily and protecting them very vigorously?
Well, I'm going to sidestep your question just a little bit and not name names, so to speak, but all the people you think should be doing it are certainly doing it. If you go to the USPTO website and you just type in user interface.
That would be U.S. Patent and Trade Office?
The U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. It's USPTO.gov. And you can go there. They have a tool that lets anybody in the world search through the patent database for the U.S. And you can do a search for user interfaces, and you'll see all the usual suspects will come up. And it is a growing area. It's becoming more and more relevant and more an area that more and more companies are using to protect their intellectual property. And it's kind of not being used as much as you think it should be because of this litigation history in the area. The Microsoft versus Apple case in particular, and the Xerox cases that not a lot of people know of that came before them, led everyone to believe that you can't protect look and feel. And it basically people relying on other people's poorly thought out legal analysis caused a whole generation of companies to miss out on protecting user interfaces.
So just to summarize, it sounds like you're saying there were a series of cases where people thought that they had protection of various kinds. It turned out in those cases that they didn't get their protection. And for a long time, people thought, well, we can't protect interface. And now people are starting to realize that actually they can in certain ways.
That's right. It started with Xerox. And Xerox, actually, when they came up with the Star, they said, hey, we came up with these neat things. Let's try and get patents on these icons on the screen. And they actually, the patents were allowed, you know, on the trash can, on the things you would think are there, that were there a long time ago. And the patents were granted, but then they were contested and ultimately invalidated. And the reason was that they made these design patents, like I spoke about earlier, and they just put in a wastebasket, right? Instead of a wastebasket on a screen, nobody thought to put that little dotted line of the screen around it. And people said, look, we've seen the wastebasket before. There's no way you're getting a claim on this. And Xerox gave up at that point. They said, well, we tried, right? Their patent lawyers said we tried. And the industry relied on that analysis. So a lot of people were relying on these cases that came before. And it was much the same for the Microsoft versus Apple case, where that case actually was rather strange in that it was brought under a contract basis and inexplicably under copyright instead of, there were no patents to speak of. But one of the reasons that there were no patents that Apple could use for the look and feel case there was that nobody believed that you could get them on the user interface. So things have changed, and thanks to some really good attorneys in the area, I guess it depends on your stance on intellectual property, whether they were good attorneys or not, but people have figured out ways to get these claims through, and now you can get them in a number of ways, and it's very protectable. And as people become more aware that you can get these design patents and user interface patents, they've become much more prevalent.
Fair enough. And I want to just one other thing generally about interface patents. I want to give listeners a sense of how much these patent applications can tell us. We know, first of all, that just because a company like Apple has an interface patent on something like, some kind of special touch sensitive screen, that they're not necessarily going to release a product on it. Those two obviously have no relationship, but can you talk a little bit about the development process and the creation of a patent? When you create a patent, do you have to have some kind of a working prototype? Do you have to have some evidence that the thing is possible to build? Or can you just cook these things up in some random lab and constantly submit all kinds of patents just to see if you can get them?
Well, to answer your last question first, yeah, you could just file nonstop on anything and everything you want. This is, and that's true of every country in the world. It's, and perhaps it's somewhat akin to the way that anybody can sue anybody over anything in America, right? You can sue a ham sandwich if you like. It doesn't mean you're going to get it, but you can certainly file all you like. As to whether or not you need a prototype, the answer is no. And there are a few reasons for it, and you could choose your poison, so to speak. One is kind of helping out the little guy, the inventor, right, who has no resources and maybe has a great big idea, but he doesn't have the resources to actually build the unit. Another one might be safety. If the little guy thought of a new nuclear reactor, I don't want him building it in his backyard as a prototype. The requirements are that you have to draft the patent application that provides a blueprint for everybody else. That's the deal, right? You're saying, I'm going to not keep my great idea secret all to myself. I'm going to share it with the world. And in return, the government's going to give me this monopoly. But as part of that deal, you're required to give a blueprint so that a person of average skill in the art, you know, Joe Average, can take that patent application, read it, and implement the invention without undue experimentation. So if I can take the patent application and basically use it to build whatever it is that your invention purports to be without, you know, inventing it myself, then you've done your job in providing a good enough description for the patent application to ultimately be granted if it's novel and non-obvious.
Fair enough. And so now on the practical question, just because I talked about all these patents, like the integrated sensing display, you know, the monitor that's also a camera, that doesn't mean that Apple's actually built one and has some functioning prototype of it in its labs.
Absolutely correct. A lot of things they could be doing, just kind of a skunk works department there that says, hey, wouldn't it be great if? I'm not saying that's exactly what Apple is doing. I'm not making any actual definitive comments on what they do or may not do. A lot of companies are known to do that. And the reason is not because they're greedy or bad or horrible. It's you have an R&D department that has a lot of great ideas. They're not exactly sure where they're going to go and what may be the future. The R&D investments are pretty sizable, but they may follow this. This may be the next great thing, and what they want to do is to protect all the research they do. Maybe the research comes to a dead end, and they realize we're never going to make this. But they want to make sure that if they are investing this money in research and development, that they do have some protection by the time that the product is out there.
That sounds good. And just one last question. I know you can't talk a lot about particular patent work that you do, but can you say what's one of the craziest patents you've seen, or one of the most exciting or weirdest or coolest things you've ever seen looking at patents?
No. I apologize, because a lot of the coolest things I see are in the pipe, so to speak, right now, and they're not public. They're still trade secrets, which is, until a patent is published, it's a trade secret, and I can't comment on them. So usually the newest and greatest bleeding edge stuff that I see is stuff that's being filed on now. As far as just the wackiest and craziest ones, you know, you've seen a lot of people, I'm sure, have seen their patent sites out there that have stupid patents, and you know, somebody got a patent for how to push someone on a swing or how to make a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. Those are crazy. you know, there's silliness like that all around there. But oh, here's a great patent, and this probably is a great tool. Just because you get a patent doesn't mean it's something that's worthwhile. One of the strangest patents I saw was a security device or a safety device to escape a burned building. And the device was a parachute that you strapped to your neck. Now, it was definitely novel in that nobody else thought to do it quite that way, and it was definitely non-obvious. That's not the first way to, you know, save yourself from a burning building that comes to mind. And it probably achieves its end in that you won't burn to death if you jump out of a building with this, but you'll die rather quickly with a broken neck. So, you know, you get silly patents like that that come through all the time. People trying to build the greatest mousetraps, and just because it gets through doesn't mean there's a lot of great value to it, which a lot of people should keep in mind too.
And one last thing, just to, you know, comfort listeners. So you can't talk about particular cool patents that you've seen, but in your opinion, there are still cool inventions, cool patents, interesting research and development going on in the world, even if you can't talk about specifically what it is.
Oh, absolutely. You know, the software patents in general get a bad rap from the open source community, and I'm with the open source community to an extent that I've seen some crappy patents, but it's not limited to just software. I've seen really silly patents, like the ones I mentioned there before, in all other areas. That being said, I've seen some insanely intricate, wonderful, and just outright genius-laden works that have been developed in the software area that are totally deserving of the protection that they get. And yeah, there are impressive people out there doing really great things. And you always think that, I'm jaded, I've seen it all. And then every so often you get someone that comes in and they've really created the greatest, latest, newest mousetrap, and it's a great idea. I think if a lot of people look at, there was a video that was going around not too long ago about the user interfaces with the touch screen, and there was a fellow that was just manipulating the screen, making the screen pan and zoom and rotate things just by moving their hands. And there was also a device out there, a prototype device I saw with a Mac implementation, where you have these little shadows of your hands come onto the screen and you can manipulate objects. And I could shoot you the link to it. But when you look at that and you think about the user interface as it is today, and it's basically stagnant from 1984, very little has changed. It's more ornamental than functional. But you look at that and you're like, here's the next new wave. This will change the way we work. Soon we'll have these 30-inch Apple displays that are like part of the desk, and you'll just be using it as part of your desk maybe. And you realize that there's something coming that may fundamentally change the way we work with not just computers, but with other people and whatnot. It's a whole different paradigm that's coming. And it does come along, maybe not as often as some people would like, but it does. And when you get to see it and be part of that process, it's a lot of fun.
And those links are in your articles, and they're all up at macobserver.com/roundup. That happy note will have to be the last word. John, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Rick.
If you have questions about the news or comments on the Context Machine or ideas for stuff that we ought to be covering here, send me an email, roundup@macobserver.com. Now for the product roundup. You can find links to these product announcements at macobserver.com/roundup. Okay, before I get underway, you may wonder why I always do the product roundup each week. You may not think that product news is all that exciting or important. Well, I think in many ways it's the most important kind of news. The Mac and iPod aren't just products, they're platforms. A lot of companies all over the world put their heart and soul into creating products that use those platforms, and it's those products that really change the way we work day to day. Along those lines, my favorite product announcement this week came from PodBop. This is a sweet idea. PodBop compiles information about upcoming music events in various cities. And this is the clever part. You can subscribe to a podcast for your area, and PodBop will send you sample tracks of the bands who are coming to play. Less innovative, but still useful, Google released 3 widgets for Tiger's dashboard this week. They're called Blogger, Gmail, and Search History. Here's something you don't see every day, a device to store weather meter data so you can download it to your Mac later. The Hobo Waterproof Shuttle from Onset Computer Corp. will be released in April. The product is waterproof up to 66 feet and can hold data from up to 63 loggers in its 4 megabytes of flash memory. It runs on a pair of AA batteries that last for about a year or 200 memory fills. Pricing is $200 US. Logitech and Adobe jointly announced the ridiculously spelled New Look Professional, a scroll wheel-like peripheral used to quickly select tools in Adobe's Creative Suite 2 applications. The product will be available in March for $150. SmartDisk announced its new PhotoBank image storage device on Thursday. The PhotoBank is a handheld device that can store up to 40 gigabytes of images from digital cameras. It offloads digital photos from flash memory cards and stores them until you're ready to download them to your computer via USB. The PhotoBank will be available in March for $180. The Viliv P1 Portable Media Player, I think that's what it's called, was launched in Korea last summer, and it's coming to the United States next month. The Video iPod Challenger features a 4-inch display, a 30-gigabyte hard drive, and a compact flash slot. Its battery can handle 6 hours of video or 11 hours of audio. Also, Vern Seward takes a look at iLife's little edition, Toast 7, and Misha Sagliarapolo reviews the OtterBox for the iPod Nano and the Extreme Pelican i1030. It's more hardcore than you are, apparently. And finally, in his Slacker's Guide, Chris Berelick takes a look at iAlarm and Growl. That's the news. Thanks for listening to the Weekly Roundup. Our content is written by the good people at the Mac Observer. Our bandwidth is provided by Cashfly, and the bass is by Boom for TMO. Run over and post up stuff on iTunes. Email me, roundup@macobserver.com. That's it. I'm done. Stay subscribed, and until next week, we'll see you online.